My name is Anthony Freud, and I'm the General Director of Lyric Opera of Chicago. Today, I'm speaking to you about Christoph Willibald Gluck's opera, Orphée et Eurydice. The recording features Richard Croft as Orphée and Mireille de Lunch as Eurydice. Mark Minkowski conducts Les Musiciens du Louvre. And special thanks to Nicholas Ivor Martin for writing this commentary. Most of us think of opera as the ultimate big art form. Scenery, costumes, music, dance, enormous orchestras, and a cast of thousands. So prepare to be surprised. Gluck's Orphée has only four principal roles. Orphée, his wife Eurydice, and two otherworldly figures, Amour and a Happy Spirit. Except that the Happy Spirit is often sung by Eurydice, as it will be in Lyric's new production. So really, three principal singers. Amour is also a small role. Although the whole opera is only 130 minutes of music, Amour sings for less than 5 minutes. So, let's say, two central principal singers. And now the surprise. One of the two central characters is dead. You're now no doubt imagining the enormous stage of the Lyric Opera House with one lonely singer standing and staring out at the audience, wondering what happens next. Keep that image in mind, because the importance of the character of Orphée in the opera is overwhelming and significant. Orphée is French for Orpheus, the quasi-mythological Greek musician and composer. But don't worry, Orphée is not a 130-minute funeral oration. For one thing, it has a happy ending. More importantly, Lyric's new production, directed, choreographed, and designed by the internationally acclaimed artistic director and chief choreographer of the Hamburg Ballet, John Neumeier, has loads to look at and to listen to. There's Lyric's impressive 60-person chorus, the Lyric Opera Orchestra, conducted by Baroque specialist Harry Bickett, and for the first time ever, a Lyric production will feature Chicago's own Joffrey Ballet and its 40-plus dancers. I believe that this is Gluck's masterpiece as it was meant to be realized. Orphée is an opera about the tension between competing extremes, Aristotle's ideal golden mean, where life and drama are found in the struggle. Orphée, the prototypical artist, is torn between life and death, hope and despair, loss and acceptance. Gluck recognized the power of those tensions and magnified them at every step. Orphée is the first of his so-called reform operas, in which he sought a new balance between musical expression and drama, reinventing old musical forms to accomplish his ends. Gluck sought a noble simplicity, which he contrasted with the Baroque complexity and ornamentation of the then fashionable opera seria. Gluck himself embraced change throughout his career, even with works he had already completed. 12 years after the 1762 premiere in Vienna, Gluck did a major revision to prepare Orphée for a premiere in Paris. The Italian libretto was replaced with a new French libretto by a different author. The music was revised with a greatly expanded role for ballet. Instrumentation was changed to reflect French tastes and innovations, and the lead character, who had been a castrato in Austria, became, in France, a high tenor. Lyric presented the 1762 Italian version, Orfeo ed Eurydice, in its 2005-2006 season. But the 2017-2018 season will open with the 1774 Paris version in a production that will reflect the excitement and tensions of Gluck's groundbreaking masterpiece. If the drama of Orphée lives in the tension between competing extremes, it's the layering of these tensions that I believe will make Lyric's presentation a moving and dramatic evening in the theatre. The plot of the opera is simple, far simpler than other treatments of which Gluck would have been aware. In the first act, Orphée mourns the death of his wife until he's encouraged by the spirit Amour to visit the underworld in the hopes of bringing her back to life. There's one condition. Orphée must not look at Eurydice until they're both back on Earth. Act 2 is Orphée's quest. He persuades the Furies to let him pass into Hades by singing to them, and the first scene ends with the famous Dance of the Furies. In the second scene, Orphée has been admitted to heaven, Elysium. Neither the beauty of the afterworld nor the dance of the blessed spirits console Orphée, who persists until the blessed spirits agree to send him back with his beloved wife. For audiences familiar with the Greek myth on which it is based, Act 3 holds the biggest surprise of the evening. Following his instructions, Orphée refuses to look at Eurydice, but since she does not know that this is a condition of her resurrection, she takes it as a sign that he no longer loves her. Her grief breaks Orphée's resolve, and when he looks at her, she dies a second time. Overcome, Orphée determines to kill himself. If he cannot have Eurydice on Earth with him, then he will join her in the afterlife. But this is not the end of the opera. Realizing the depth of Orphée's love for his wife, Amour relents and brings Eurydice back to life a second time. The opera ends with an extended ballet celebrating the happy outcome. The tension between competing extremes in Gluck's Orphée begins with the ancient Greek source myth itself. Eurydice is dead and then not. Orphée lives, yet is somehow enabled to pass into the underworld. This is not consistent with reality. Whatever one thinks of descriptions of strange, near-death experiences, the term itself concedes that the person in question is not dead. The dead do not return. Are we meant to learn something deeper from Eurydice's unsuccessful resurrection in Greek mythology and her successful reincarnation in the opera? The story sounds like a parable, a fact that reminds us that Eurydice is not the only ancient successfully resurrected, nor the only one killed by a glance. Hades abducts Demeter's daughter, Persephone. Demeter, being the Greek goddess of the harvest, her grief over the loss of her daughter has far-reaching consequences. Nothing grows, and people begin to starve. Rather than allow the extinction of life on Earth, Zeus intervenes. Persephone is successfully returned to Earth, although with different conditions in different versions of the myth. Persephone's disappearance explains the seasons, an understandable if unscientific lesson. But what about Lot's wife? In the book of Genesis, angels instruct her not to look back as she's fleeing Sodom. And when she does, she turns into a pillar of salt, a presumably fatal condition. Various interpretations have been put on the fate of Lot's wife. The simplest is that she disobeyed a divine order. The angels told her not to, and divine orders are meant to be obeyed, no matter how incomprehensible or arbitrary they seem. A slightly more complex explanation is that in looking back, Lot's wife saw God descending to destroy Sodom, and the sight of the divine power killed her. This interpretation emphasizes the immense power of God and puts the angels' actions in a better light. But it fails to explain why the warning came without explanation. If Lot's wife had been told why she wasn't supposed to look back, she might have complied. Ultimately, we're left with another story of the consequences of disobedience to higher authority. One of the more interesting interpretations of the Bible story suggests that the glance was not cause but effect. Lot's wife did not want to leave and had not repented. Hence, she was not worthy to be saved from the general destruction. The Orpheus legend is susceptible to myriad interpretations. One could easily equate looking on Eurydice while she's dead with accepting her fate, which in turn suggests that Eurydice's resurrection may not be literal, but figurative. The idea that she survives in the memories of those who loved her sounds like a very modern concept, if one with less upside for Eurydice herself. The tension between the story we're being told and our understanding of the awful finality of death creates a cognitive tension that makes us dig deeper and get more out of the opera. The structure and form of the opera itself is also a masterpiece of controlled tension and chaos. The first opera ever presented is thought to have been Daphne by Jacopo Peri, given in Florence in 1597. The music for that is lost, so the first opera we have a copy of is one Peri wrote 3 years later, in 1600, with fellow composer Giulio Caccini. That opera was Euridice, the Italian name for Orpheus's wife. And since we're on the subject, the earliest opera composer whose works are still regularly performed is Claudio Monteverdi. And Monteverdi's first opera, written in 1607, was, you guessed it, Orfeo. My point, however, is that when Gluck's first version premiered in 1762, opera was already 165 years old. Gluck was as close in time to the first Euridice opera as we are to La Traviata. Traviata is a great opera, but one or two things have changed since it was written. Opera has been around for 400 years because it continually reinvents itself. And Gluck's Orfeo was an important transitional work that modified without eliminating what were then already worn operatic conventions, resurrected them, we might say. One thing that Gluck preserved was the operatic fascination with Greek mythology. One might suspect that the preponderance of early operas about Orpheus is due to its subject matter. Orpheus is a musician, the prototype of all musicians and composers. What composer, what person really, does not think that his own occupations are more interesting and important than anyone else's? But from its inception, opera had a philosophical reason for taking its subjects from Greek mythology. The Renaissance composers who invented the form wished to resurrect the dramatic forms of ancient Greece. Using their mythology was a logical corollary. And yet, by Gluck's time, many aspects of the art form were growing stale. The court composer of the French king Louis XIV, Jean-Baptiste Lully, created and enforced a uniquely French style of opera until his death in 1687. Italy, meanwhile, had grown accustomed to opera seria, a form that emphasized individual singers and complex improvised vocal ornamentation over a tight dramatic story. With Orfeo, Gluck set out to reform opera, which did not mean to replace it entirely. What still worked in the form could stay. Everything else had to go. Traditional opera seria was built around the da capo aria, a set piece for a virtuoso singer divided into three parts: an exposition, a contrasting middle section, and then a return of the first section with added ornamentation. The repetition, the de-emphasis of text, the importance of vocal flourishes, and the principle that an aria expressed a character's emotion rather than furthering the plot, severely impeded the drama. Orfeo was shocking to audiences of its time, in part because it abandoned the da capo aria. A second pillar of opera seria was recitative. Since da capo arias did not include plot development or dialogue, both had to be inserted between the arias as short bursts of declamatory singing set to very simple accompaniment, a harpsichord or a few string instruments. Gluck did not abandon recitative altogether, but it was made more musical and accompanied by the full orchestra. In the light of this new development, the more traditional and less interesting form of recitative needed a new name, which became the uncomplimentary secco recitative or dry recitative. Gluck's variation did not, alas, come to be known as wet recitative, but rather recitativo strumentato or accompagnato, instrumental or accompanied recitative. In the first act, when Orfeo sings about his grief at Eurydice's death, he does so in an aria where each verse is separated by accompanied recitative. In the aria portion, he tells us that at night he calls out Eurydice's name, hoping she will return. The recitative begins with that cry of pain, Eurydice, Eurydice, dear shadow, where are you? This fusing of aria and recitative is still dramatic today, and it was radical for its time. Oh! The other remarkable thing to notice in that excerpt is that each time Orphée calls out, there is an answer, an echo, not from Eurydice, who is gone, but from a different orchestral instrument. One of the interesting things about innovators like Gluck is that they do not tend to get locked into a single way of doing things. In the original Vienna version, the echoes are produced by flute, horns, and English horn. In Paris, the composer found not only different fashions in instruments, but different levels of ability by the players of those instruments. The flute echo becomes a clarinet. Other instruments that he had used in Vienna, cornets and the chalumeau, a single reed woodwind, were replaced by oboes and clarinets. The trombone parts were de-emphasized, possibly because the trombone players in Paris were not up to the composer's standard. Instrumentation was not the only scoring that changed substantially in the move to Paris. Orphée had been portrayed by a castrato in Vienna, following the Italian tradition. Even in Italy, castrati would soon fall out of favour with audiences, but they'd never been embraced by French audiences. Gluck therefore transposed and rewrote the part, translating it to a high tenor. One thing that did not change was the instrument Gluck chose to represent Orphée's famous lyre, the harp. Listen for it throughout the opera. Parisian orchestras before the 1770s did not typically contain a harp, and the subsequent change is thought to have been due to Gluck's influence. For all the changes Gluck made, Orphée is still rife with pre-reform conventions, beginning with that bouncy excerpt from the overture, which is thematically unrelated to the rest of the evening. The vast expansion of dance for the Parisian version was as much an accommodation to pre-existing Parisian tastes as it was an innovation. The tug of war between old and new forms sometimes shocked Gluck's 18th century audiences, but even today, it gives tension and excitement to the score. The final tension between competing extremes has been, if not added, at least extended by Lyric in the way we went about creating this production. When we first considered presenting Orphée in Lyric season, it felt as if we would be letting Gluck down if we were not to approach it with the same spirit of innovation and reform that had motivated the composer. The company had presented the Vienna version of the opera four times before, always in Italian. In 1962, Maria Tolchev appeared on stage as one of the solo dancers. She'd been discovered at the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo by legendary choreographer Georges Balanchine and would eventually marry him. After a distinguished international career as a dancer, Tolchev would retire to Chicago to lead the Chicago City Ballet and for decades act as Lyric Opera's ballet director. In 1975, Lyric presented the opera with Richard Stilwell and Ileana Kotrubash in the title roles. Balanchine was the choreographer. The production and choreography were revived 2 years later. Finally, in 2005-2006, Lyric presented a new production by director Robert Carson, featuring countertenor David Daniels as Orfeo, but omitting most of the dance music. John Neumeier's distinguished career as a dancer began with the Stuttgart Ballet in the 1960s, but he was born in Milwaukee and tells me that as a young man, he danced in a production on the Lyric stage. His transition to international choreographer began in the 1960s, and in 1969, he was appointed director of the Frankfurt Ballet. From there, he moved to Hamburg to become artistic director and chief choreographer of the Hamburg Ballet, a position he's held since 1973. John has choreographed over 100 works, many of them full-length narrative ballets, and he's probably unique in having choreographed ballets set to Gustav Mahler's 1st, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, and 9th symphonies, as well as Das Lied von der Erde. presumably symphonies numbers 2, 7, and 8 are in the works. He's thus no stranger to tradition, innovation, or the creativity that can flourish in a struggle between the two. For this production, we have appointed him a stage director, choreographer, and designer, a highly unusual combination. Gluck's opera is told with an enormous range of artistic forces, singers, dancers, choristers, instrumentalists. And yet, it is also the story of a single man, a single artist, and his struggle with the divine. What more appropriate way to reflect this than by appointing a unified artistic leader for the production? In today's world of hyper-specialization, we're fortunate to have in John Neumeier someone capable of rising to such an artistic challenge. Of course, John is principally known as a brilliant choreographer. Gluck may have been bowing to Parisian tradition when he added ballet music to Orfeu, but the extent and beauty of the dance music is remarkable for opera. The Dance of the Furies and the Blessed Spirits in Act II and the extended ballet at the end of the opera are phenomenal opportunities for any choreographer. John's vision for Orfeu gives place to both past and present. And by naming him as director, choreographer, and designer of the opera, we've made it possible for him to be our own modern Orpheus, giving full rein to his creative insights. I don't want to give away too much about the production, which I hope you will attend, but John has costumed the dancers, chorus, and singers for today, 2017, while setting the opera in a white, abstract landscape of ancient Greek temples. Our Eurydice dies in a car crash, which for me emphasizes the tragedy by denying us the ability to mythologize it away. This Orfeu is destined to take its place as one of the great lyric productions, and I hope you will join us for it in October.
The music that you have heard is generously furnished by Warner Classics and is available for purchase on iTunes.